Hi, my name's Al, an alcoholic. Welcome all the new people. And happy birthday to the birthday people. And I was just kind of yakking to some people during the meeting, you know. And you guys are really a pretty good group. You know what I mean? You are really active, and I just want to put that out there for you so you know that. And I've never really said that at a before, but I'm really impressed. Really. I usually, before I talk, I kind of like to listen to my spiritual tapes, my spiritual stuff, and so, you know, so I can get in the right tone for it. And what happened is that I left my iPod at home, so and as my spiritual tape is like Johnny Cash. It's my because I love cowboy music, you know what I mean? And there's nothing better in the world than drinking and listening to sad songs. You know, feeling bad, you know what I mean? Oh, God, Cliff, give me another Falstaff and change for the jukebox, you know. And he had one song that I really liked called Tell Rose I Love Her, you know, and it was a story about the guy just got out of prison. He's walking along the railroad track, and he falls over, and he's laying there dying. And another bum walks by, and he's got this whole bag of money that he had stolen and he had dug up, apparently, when he got out of prison. And he gives it to this bum, and he says, give this to Rose and tell I love her, and tell my son that he's a man of the house now. Now, I must have been sober about 4 or 5 years before I figured out that bum never gave the money to him. He split with it, you know what I mean? But I started drinking when I was like 16 years old, and the reason I started drinking is because I had to, and I really didn't know it. You know, the reason us alcoholics drank is because we suffered. You know, and because we suffered. Now, if there was a thing if I was to change anything in the big book, which you shouldn't change, but if I was to change anything, they said that some alcoholics have mental and emotional problems. I would change it that all alcoholics, when they come on the program, have mental and emotional problems. If they didn't, the second step wouldn't say that you would be restored to sanity. Because in a sense, when it's saying that I'd be restored to sanity, it's saying there's a relationship between sanity and the way I think. Saying, I remember when I was sober around. I tried to quit smoking when I was sober 2 years. And I couldn't do it. Then when I was sober 5 years, I gave it a shot. I went to the 7-day Adventist church, and they had a 5-day no smoking plan. And I took their plan, and I quit smoking. I went straight from Cool Cigarettes to Winchell's Donuts. Do you know what I mean? And every time you saw me, I was eating something. You know, I was jamming something in my mouth. And after I had stopped smoking for about 6 months, I weighed about 235 pounds. You know what I mean? So what I did is I checked myself into Overeaters Anonymous, you know, and that's desperate. And, you know, this is going to be pretty heavy for Las Vegas. I don't know if you can get it. But did you know there's a relationship between what you eat and what you weigh? Sort of like a karmic thing, you know what I mean? I could eat an apple fritter and, you know, and get on my hands and knees and turn my will over to the care of God. And apple fritter don't give a crap. It's just you're going to pound on the pounds, you know. You put it on because it does, you know, that doesn't care. And it's the same thing, you know. There's a relationship between what I think between what I think and what my life is about. My sponsor, I got sober at Salvation Army. The reason I got sober at Salvation Army is because I was living there. You know? And he took me out, and he told me what the nature of the disease of alcoholism is. See? What it is, it's an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. You know, it's an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And I know that there's new people that didn't hear this. And what it is, it's an allergy of the body and an obsession of the mind. And what that means is when I'm not drinking and doing drugs, all I've really done is handle the allergy. You know, like if you get these people that check into these recovery places, they come to places for 30 days, they pay 45 grand or maybe 12 grand or whatever. I don't know what the latest thing is going. But what happens is in that 30 days, all they really do is get the wrinkles out of their stomach and they're no longer drinking and doing drugs. All they've really done is handle the allergy. They haven't handled the disease. And the disease is the mind. You know? And do you know what the function of the mind is? My sponsor's name was Shep. He says, Al, do you know what the function of the mind is? He says, the function of the mind is thinking. Let me give you an idea that he had just taken. I had stayed in Salvation Army 90 days. And he moved me, and he was my sponsor, and he took me out, and he moved me into his house. And he told me I can only stay there for free room and board for 6 weeks. At the end of 6 weeks, I'd be gone. I'd have to get a job, save some money, and run a place. And this is in Hawaii. And so I'm sitting there at his breakfast room table when he's telling me that. I had just gotten out of Salvation Army. I'd been living in the swamp down in Pearl Harbor and for like a couple of years. I deserted my wife. My son was adopted away from me. And I was wanted for 18 felony counts. And the first thing that came to my mind is I thought, is this guy trying to tell me that there's something wrong with the way I think? You know what I mean? It was hard for me to realize there's a relationship between the way I think and me being at Salvation Army. It was hard, you know, and that's why the book says somewhere that our chances are nil till we get rid of our old ideas. Now, till we get rid of our old ideas. Now, what is an old idea? Why would I have to get rid of my old ideas? Because the reason I drank is based upon my old ideas. Based upon my old ideas. I'll give you an example. One of the old ideas I had is my dad told me, whatever you do, don't hang around with Mexicans. If you ever want to find a Mexican, look in a welfare line underneath a tree, they're taking a siesta. Only thing wrong is my dad was Mexican. See what I mean? And I'm really young. I'm probably around 5 years old when I'm getting this conditioning. You know what I mean? I'm getting this conditioning. And so I believed I had begun the magical belief of being unworthy. I was unworthy. Then the next thing that happened to me, it was I was molested by my uncle when I was 7 years old. That never ever happened to anybody in the world. Nobody ever in the world had been molested. Only me, and I could never ever really tell anybody that. And so I began seeing myself. What that did is that reinforced that belief. And I was living in South Pasadena at the time, and I went to school. When they sent me to, like, you know, I was going to school, and I was going there, and I was, as a kid, what I had done is I had used. Now, here's the biggest mistakes that causes us to suffer, is that I had used these things that had happened to me to identify myself with. I had used those to say, ah, this is me. See, I had used those to say, ah, this is me. Then when I go to school with that ego belief, I look at the kids around me, and I see they're all, you know, I mean, there's South Pasadena. All these kids running around with corduroys, corduroy pants, cashmere shirts, and cashmere sweaters, rather, and white bucks, you know. And I'm looking at them, and I said, they got their life together, and I don't. They got their life together, and the teacher's teaching, and I'm looking around comparing myself to other people all the time. Do you follow me? And what happens is I didn't learn because my attention wasn't there. So therefore, what happened is what other information added on to the self-identity of myself to cause me to suffer as I began seeing myself as dumb. You follow me? Then the next one, which is a topper, which is a great winner, is and I got nothing against religion. Don't get me wrong. You know, I mean, if you're a Christian, cool, you're Buddhist or whatever you are, cool. That's your path. But what had happened, some or other, I had misinterpreted. But what I had interpreted is that I was taught that I was born in sin. Didn't even get out of the gate, I'm bad. You understand that? Not out of the gate, I'm a bad person. I'm unworthy. And that's me. So I began seeing myself. So I remember when I go to junior high school, everything's cool till all of a sudden when the hormones come in, the brains go out. You know what I mean? When you're going to school. And so all of a sudden I'm going to school and girls come into play. You know, and I remember the first girl I made a pass at. I was 13 years old. It was after dancing class, right? And we went out, and I sat down in her mom's car in the back seat, and I asked her if I could put my arm around her. And she said no. You know what I mean? And I wondered, how did she find these things out about me? You know what I mean? Because how I would define myself, and I was seeing myself now, was that sexually perverted, dumb, sinning Mexican. You understand? That's not a good way to look at yourself. But if you see yourself on a subtle basis downside, if you see yourself I saw myself based upon that. So you could understand what caused the suffering. But see, the suffering, we suffer so gradually we don't know it. It's like, you know how you put a frog in water, in cold water, in the stove, and you turn it up. And the frog keeps adapting till it's finally it's cooked. See? And that's what happened to me. That's what happens to us. We have become so accustomed to suffering. We have become so accustomed to suffering that we think that's the way it is. Typically, I mean, we are totally darkened. Totally darkened. I mean, I'll give you an example. How many times have you gone to a meeting and heard somebody say, "Oh man, shit. Oops, sorry. God. How do you stand the now, man? What do I do? How do I stay in the now?" What you do is you stand up in the back of the room and ask them, well, where do you think you're at? We're always there. We're always there. There isn't a moment we're not here. We're always here. But what happens is when they say, "Is there any visitors?" Most of the people ought to raise their hand because they're not here. They're in their head, you know. And the reason they're in their head is they think their head knows what it's talking about. You know what I mean? What brought me to a state of consciousness to where I believe that I'm just an extension of God. God totally loves and supports me. God is just like all of us. I mean, the spiritual awakening. The spiritual awakening is when we realize that who we are and what we are is an extension of God. She created us good. We're good now, and we always have been. And any idea that that there's something wrong with us, or we are bad, is our defects of character, and we need to investigate that. You understand that? Now, what would take me to be where I would begin to have that sort of consciousness, to believe that I know God's taking care of me right now, and that all That's all there really is right here. I'm never going to be anywhere else but right here. Never. Anything outside of that is only imagination. But what would take me to that state of consciousness? It just doesn't happen like that. It has to be cultivated. And how it began cultivated, how it began to get cultivated is that this buddy of mine realized when I was 16 years old that I wasn't taking any girls out. So he fixed me up with this redhead, and I've always, that's been my favorite hair color ever since. Fixed me up with this redhead, and we went to this drive-in theater in Arcadia, and we sat there, and I sat in the back seat there, and I was holding up the doorknob, and I was running it through my mind, should I ask her if I could put my arm around her, or should I not? Should I ask her, or should I not? And he's rolling around in the front seat with his girlfriend, and every once in a while, she'd tap me with her knee, and my head would go, I'd have a coronary there in the car. And from there, we went to Fish Canyon up in Tewarty, and we parked up there, and he kicked me out. Oh, you've been there. And he kicked me out and gave me, and this gal Shirley, a bottle of Garrett's California White Port, and told us to go out and sit underneath the tree. And I was cool at that time, and how you knew I was cool is I was wearing the uniform that all the kids wore at that time, a leather jacket, engineer boots, Levi's rolled up, white T-shirt. And I went, and I was smoking. I just started smoking then. And I'm blowing smoke in her face with my collar up like this, you know. You know, let her know I'm cool, right? And she takes that jug of Garrett's California White Port. Let me get my collar now, yeah. Takes that jug and she tilts it up and she holds it up there for about 5 minutes, you know what I mean? And then when she puts it down, says, I'm cool. I can't let her drink more than me. You know what I mean? I can't. And the reason, you know the reason why you have to be cool? Because you can't be who you are. And the reason you can't be who you are is because you think you are who you think you are. You know what I mean? See? And so I was cool, and I took that bottle of Caras California White Port, and I put it up. And, you know, to this day, I don't remember putting that bottle down. I just had my arms around her talking 100 miles a minute, you know. I was talking. I mean, I was wonderful, you know. I was a combination. I saw myself as being a combination between Fred Astaire and Earl Flynn, you know what I mean. That's how I saw myself. That's what booze did for me. And the reason it does for me is there's three ears. There's one ear here, there's one ear here. Then there's one ear inside that hears stories. And the story was that every time I would go into a room and I would feel uncomfortable. And the reason I would feel uncomfortable in the room is because I knew these people were phony. You know, but that isn't why I felt uncomfortable. It's because I would go into the room and I'd feel uncomfortable and my head would say, what are you doing here, you sinning, dumb, perverted Mexican? What are you doing in this room? Look, you know, I mean, but it's so instantaneous. You know, I mean, you heard people say, you know, how drinking made me feel comfortable, or I couldn't do things. And the reason drinking made me feel comfortable is because I had ideas, I had old ideas in my mind that caused me to suffer. And when I drank, it shut off that ear. It didn't hear the message. Didn't hear the message. And so I took off. I took off. I mean, I spent 4 years in the service. I went in there Airman Basic and got out of Airman Basic. I got a general discharge under honorable conditions. You know, and then I tried different ways of good drinking. I bought a lifetime membership to Vic Tanny's. You know, didn't work. I went three times, and I'm back in the 101 in Arcadia, telling Cliff, give me a Falstaff and change for the jukebox. And the next thing I did is I got married. And I figured I'd get a hold of this girl. And I married this gal that was 19 and I was 26. And I figured that she was she was really rigid, you know what I mean? I figured I'd get somebody to straighten me up. I need somebody to straighten. And she did the best she could. But about a year and a half later, she's standing there holding my son David. She's asking to make a choice between this thunderbirding, and I love the bird. You know what I mean? You know, it's the nectars of God, you know. 20% by volume, you know what I mean? I never could understand these guys that drank wine, that 12% wine. I could never understand that, you know. You know, I can't, and I've done workshops at some of these recovery homes, right? And I run into there, and there's a lot of women. You'd be surprised how many women drink that, are in there because they drank a lot of 12% wine. But that had to be a lot of drinking, you know. But I like the bird, and I forgot what I was talking about now. Yeah, oh, yeah, thank you. Somebody's listening. Thank you for listening. And so I said, forget about it. I said, don't worry about me. Who needs you? I'm taking off. You know, I don't need you. You know, don't worry, I'll take care of you. 2 weeks later, I lost my job. And the reason I lost my job is I couldn't get up in the morning, go to work. I couldn't, because I had nobody to get me up. Nobody make my lunch. She took the car away from me, you know what I mean? 19 years old, 26, she took the car away from me. And nobody to drive me to the bus stop. You know, but I remember where this buddy of mine kept his checkbook. And I knew he wouldn't mind if I took it because the account was closed. So I reopened his account for him. And 18 felony counts later, I took off. I caught an airplane to Hawaii. And that was, they didn't have jets then. That was, they flew the Constellation, I think it was something like that. It took 10 and a half hours to fly there. And I got there, and I lived downtown in the Alexander Young Hotel for a week. I never paid the rent. And I spent all my money running up and down Hotel Street drinking. And I left there and never paid my rent. I had to leave my clothes. And you figured that would be the end of the road, but it wasn't. I went over and I got a job as a bartender, because I'd been stationed there before earlier in the service. And I got a job as a bartender and bouncer there. And he told me a place I could live across the street, a place called Samoan Village. And my rent was $36 a month, right? The reason they called it Samoan Village is because Samoans lived there, you know what I mean? And my room was about the size of that birthday cake. And my bed, they had one room had a box spring and the other room had a mattress, you know? And I had the box spring, and I still got a scar where a wire from the box spring went through my leg. And but I lived there for like a couple of years, and it really wasn't a total negative thing, because I found out that people can be really happy on very little. You know, I found that out because a lot of these people didn't have very much. But I ended up not able to pay my rent because I was, well, I got fired from my job for drinking, and then I ended up not being able to pay my rent. So what I did is I subleased part of my room to another guy. And he didn't have a job, so the two of us couldn't pay the rent, right? So we moved over to, you know, my landlady kicked us out. We moved over to the next village called Filipino Village, right? That's because Filipinos live there, right? And I remember there was a burnout car there. We moved into a burnout car. And I'll give you a hint. If you guys ever go out drinking again, don't sleep in a burnout car, because there's no cushions. They're gone, you know what I mean? And it was underneath a mango tree, and there was rotten mangoes laying all the ground. And at that time, I was drinking Triple Jack wine, because Thunderbird was $1 and Triple Jack was 85 cents. See, but it's still 20% by volume. And so I was sleeping in the bottle like this, and I'd roll out from the back of the car onto those rotten mangoes, and those flies would be flying around me. And I'd look up at the highway, and me and my buddy's name was Pete. I said, Pete, And we'd say, those guys don't know how to live, do they? They'd stand up there waiting to go to work, you know. And then I couldn't hand that outdoor living, so I got myself a job. The last job I had as a practicing social drinker was babysitting for two bottles of wine a day and a pack of Cools. And once in a while, I was a living maid. And once in a while, she'd bring home a bottle of Kamchatka vodka. She had two kids, and I'd get up in the morning and I'd feed them, their post-toasties and stuff. And pour them their milk and, do stuff, make sandwiches. And I had to wash her clothes. And I learned how to wash clothes and learned how to iron. I ironed her stuff, ironed her favorite dress and hung it up there. And this is no sex involved. I was a living maid. You know what I mean? This is it. For two bottles of wine a day and a pack. It was a good job. You know what I mean? Two bottles of wine a day, a pack of Cools. And she'd bring a bottle of Kamchatka vodka. Half a pint of Kamchatka vodka once in a while. And I got a letter then saying from, I got a letter, it worked its way to me, and it's, my mom told me that my son was adopted away from me because I didn't contribute to the support of the child. Then about 2 weeks later, President Kennedy got assassinated. And they say that when President Kennedy got assassinated, that a lot of people's lives changed, you know what I mean? And I happened to fall in that category because when President Kennedy got assassinated, it just was a real impact for me, a real impact for me. And I went out that last, that was on the 22nd of November, 1963. And my sobriety date is November, next day I got sober, November 23rd, 1963. I checked into, I called up the Greater Council on Alcoholism, and a guy named J.C. Martelon took me and was a counselor, and he talked to me, and he said, I'm going to check into Salvation Army. And so I checked into Salvation Army, and the first meeting I went to, the guy had led the meeting, slept next to me. The guy was like ancient. He was like 50 years old. Loaded ice boxes and stoves on back of trucks. And he said when he read chapter, and had, besides that, the guy pickled hard-boiled eggs, and he had the worst case of gas in the world. He could have, remember that campfire scene in Blazing Saddles? He could have won an Academy Award for that movie, just if they put him in there, you know what I mean? And so when he read chapter 5, and if you decide you want what we have and are willing to go at any lengths to get it, I didn't want what he had. Because all you want to do is get sober and move over to the next bed. So the next thing that happened is, I went the following week, Dan McVeigh was the guy's name, was leading the meeting, and I still didn't want what he had. But the third week, they said a bunch of people, sort of like a group of people, was going to come and put a meeting on for us. And this guy doesn't mind me breaking his anonymity. His guy's name was Bud Tollefson. And he comes pulling up in almost a new car. And on the right-hand side of this car was this blonde that was so hot. We could have a moment of silence just for her. And he gets up behind the wheel, and she gracefully slides. It looks like she glided over there, And he gets out from behind the car, and she drives. Hank gives her a kiss, and she drives off with the almost new car. And he walks up, and the guy's got on a white shirt. Now we're talking 63, man. Peter Gunn, and remember, I don't know if a lot of you guys are too young, but Peter Gunn and Richard Diamond continental clothes in style at that time. And he comes walking in style, and man, he had a white shirt and slim Jim tie, one of them collar things hooked underneath there like that. Continental pants, with the tight legs. And real sharp checkered jacket, looking good, right? When he got up there and said, if you read chapter 5, if you decide you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, I wanted what he had. I wanted that girl, that car, and that sport coat. That's what I wanted, you know what I mean? So I went up to him, and the meeting was over. And I told him, I gave him my, you know how we all have our sad stories when we come in here? We could sit it to music. Do you ever try that? Get a newcomer to start telling me his story and play some music behind it, and you'll just, it's great. And so what happens, I give him my sad story. And when he gets finished, when he got finished hearing it, he says, look, let me tell you what. And he goes like this, his sponsor was Al Marino. He goes just like my test. He says, you take care of your number one problem and everything else will take care of itself. And I said, well, what's my number one problem? He says, your number one problem is go to a meeting every night for the first 90 days. I said, do I have to go every night? He said, well, how often did you drink? I said, I'll go every night, you know. And you hear that, you know, you hear people say, go to meetings every night, go to meetings every night, go to meetings every night, you know. And you think, I mean, you hear that so much, it's just, you hear it so much, you really don't pay attention to it. It's like when they're reading chapter 5 at the beginning of the meeting, people say, nobody's listening, you know, they're looking around or something like that. It's the same with the meetings going on every night. But see, that's probably the most important message. Go to meetings every night. Why is it an important message for me? My sponsor told me, do you know why that's important for you? He says, because your chances are nil till you get rid of the old ideas. And you know what the word definition for nil is? No chance. No chance. No chance. Unless I get rid of my old ideas. Now, old ideas, you can't say, oh, that's a bad idea, and get rid of it. You know, to think that God's punishing and terrible is a bad idea. Now, I'm just going to get rid of it. Well, it doesn't work that way. What I have to do is I have to discover a new idea. How did I find out God wasn't a Catholic? How many people in this room are not Catholics and are sober? Raise your arm. Well, there it is. How many people in this room are sober and not Christian? Raise your arm. Okay, so what would happen is I had the experience realizing that God not only wasn't Catholic, that God wasn't even a Christian. Now that really, and my brother didn't like to hear that, and he's not an alcoholic. He's a born-again Christian, you know what I mean? But you see, it says God is, we understand God. So I had to, and so when I found that out by going to meetings. I found out that God totally loved and supports me, that God is a loving God. You know, God's a loving God. Found that out. I found out how to live a day at a time in Alcoholics Anonymous. How do you learn how to live it a day at a time? Is I've been sober 42 years, and I haven't quit drinking, and I haven't stopped using drugs. I just don't do it between now and when I go to bed tonight. I don't do it between now and when I go to bed tonight. I was sober like 10 years. I was sober around 10 years and I hit a wall. You know, I thought the answer would be, I need to write another inventory. That's what I need to do. You know, alcoholics are, I've never seen anybody so self-obsessed as us alcoholics. You know what I mean? Every problem they have, what they need to do is we need to write about, we need to inventory. I need to write more about myself. More about me. And the more I know about me, the better off. I think I'm going to think this over. You know, I'm not going to go to a meeting tonight. I'm going home and think this over. Jesus. You know, that's like getting Bush to investigate Bush. You know, give me a break. But see, I didn't know that. I didn't know that. I was totally darkened. You know what I mean? Sober 10 years, totally darkened. And how I was darkened is my life was being run by drama. Drama. And you know how you can spot drama? It's not happening. Imagine that. I'm running my life based upon what isn't happening or what's going to happen or living my life based upon what should be, or it ought to be that way. The definition for what should be or ought to be, the simple definition for that is not is. Isn't that a bitch? And I wondered why my life didn't work. You know, I wondered why I felt bad. You know, I wonder why I felt bad. Oh, I got to kick back quickly for a minute. How I handled the issue about being Mexican, I found out that my dad lied to me. You know, just to be Mexican is just to be Mexican. It's not good or bad. I mean, I'm not too proud of my other half Irish, but... But, you know, if she didn't want me to be Mexican and Irish, she wouldn't have created me that way. You know, and how you do Mexican and Irish, I'll do it for you. I just did it. You know, do it again. See, I just did it. See, I did it again. See, it's very easy. It's very easy. You just don't have to pretend. It's not, isn't that a bitch? The next thing that happened is the thing about being molested. And about being molested is when I took my inventory, first three inventories, I never shared it with my sponsor. But the fourth time, I had to do it, man. I had to do it. So I went, I went up to see Shep. He lived on top of Red Hill Road that overlooked Pearl Harbor. I sat down, and I figured I'm going to tell him, and he's going to kick me out of the yard. So I said, Shep, Sonny molested me. And he went, guess what happened? Hit my knee and said, guess what happened to me? You know what I mean? And I was set free. He says, you know what? He says, you're going to share that. I said, I'll never tell anybody again. You know, and I've talked at conventions, and I've shared it at conventions, and I've had people come up and say, thank you for sharing me. Because it's that key, that it's this key that I share with you that sets you free if you happen to up to it. You know, what happens is, if I had to really carry a message that I really want people to absorb in your hearts, is realize you are not the things you do or the things you've done. We are not that. If we are not that, who and what are we? And that's the wall I hit when I was sober 10 years old. Sober 10 years old. I had all these dramas. I had a relationship drama going on here. Like Dallas going on here, Gunsmoke going on there, Dynasty going on here. All these different dramas we got going on with our life. You know what I mean? And all they are stories. But, you know, we think we're that. We think we're that. We think we're these stories, you know. It's like watching television, and like I got addicted to 24 hours. It's like watching 24 hours and identifying and being that. You know what I mean? It's only a program. It's only a program. And so what happens is the way the steps are set up, we become detached from the things we've done when we take our inventory. We become free of that. The next thing is when we ate the ninth step, we become free. We become free of the people. We complete our relationships in our life. Unless I complete the relationship with my mom and dad, unless I complete my relationship with them, my life's not going to work, because the mind, the way it works, is going to keep, I'll keep getting other relationships till I complete it. It took me a long time to complete my relationship to my mom, but I've been married five times. Sooner or later, you got to figure, there's something wrong here. You know, so I completed it with my mom, and now I've been happily married now, like for 24 years, and we've been together for 27 years, you know. But let's go back to that 10-year period now. About being dumb, I just accept I'm not the smartest guy in the world. You know, just that's who I am. That's it. And so what happens is I call up my sponsor. He says, you probably got to learn how to meditate. So I went over to the Bodhi Tree. I bought four or five books on meditating and read them. And that's not called meditating. You know, that's called reading books about meditation. You know, the next one I'd be sitting, and you know, I'd get to read the 24-hour-a-day book and get a cup of coffee and go in the bathroom, and I'd sit there, and all of a sudden, just before I go to the bathroom, it seemed like I'd have a spiritual awakening or something, you know. And that's what that's called, is drinking coffee, going to the bathroom, and reading the 24-hour-a-day book. interested. So what happens is nothing really works. So I went to see this. I went down to New Hampshire Street in Los Angeles to see this to this Buddhist temple, and there was this Jewish monk, Buddhist monk. And he ended up in Japan on a bad drug deal, and he checked in a monastery and come back 12 years later as a meditation teacher. And the guy's really good. His name is Shinzing Young. And I went and saw him, and he interviewed me, and he said, "You got one of the grossest minds I've ever had." And I have a garden variety alcoholic mind who's totally hypnotized by what's not happening. You understand that? Hypnotized by not what's happening. So he had me. He taught me how to meditate. And so he told me, get a candle. Like I was telling our buddy there at the, or your friend there over at the little table there, at the sound table, I was telling him, what you do is you get a candle here, put a clock there, set the clock for 10 minutes, and only look at that candle there for 10 minutes. Just hang out with the candle. Hang out with the candle. Hang, just me and the... Me. And what happens, the thoughts come by, you let them go, thoughts come by, you let them go. Thoughts come by, you let them go, thoughts come by, you let them go. And if some thought come by and it doesn't want to be let go, it wants to, you know, them thoughts that want to hang out, want to beat the daylights out of you, you know what I mean? Like those Buddhists talk about, those the guys in India talk about sitting underneath a banyan tree. And a banyan tree is full of monkeys chattering away. And what they do is they sit there and they pull down one of those monkeys, turn into a gorilla, and scare themselves with it. There's a story about a Buddhist monk who's a great artist. He painted a picture of a ferocious tiger in his cave. And he had to move. He had to move. And so what happens is we do the same thing. You know, with our, I'm sitting there, and if a thought comes in and it won't go away, all I really do is say, look, I usually have a chair or something around. So why don't you go sit down there and take it easy. When I'm finished, I'll come pick you up. Don't worry. Then I go back over here. And I go back over here and I stay here. And what happens is that I meditate regularly. I do it for a half an hour. And the benefits of meditation is moves you. It lets you, number one, I realize that I'm not my thoughts. Like if I've taught meditation. And if I'm going to do a simplified version of meditation, and I would say I'd take this guy with the yellow shirt, take him out with his hand, and we'd stand on the street corner. We'd watch cars go by. There goes a Ford. There goes a Hummer. There goes a truck. There goes a VW. There goes a drag. There goes a Chevy. There goes another Ford. And you watch the cars go by, you see. Thoughts are identically the same way. You watch them go by. You watch them go by. You watch them go by identically the same way. We are not the thoughts. We are not the, I am not my thoughts. I run your thoughts. I could say something like, think of a pink giraffe having sex with a gorilla. You know, all of a sudden, I run your thoughts there. I got you to think about that, you see. What happens? So we're not in charge. And then we say, I'm thinking all the time. Of course. You will be thinking till you drop dead. It's part of knowing that, that the release is that I'm not my thoughts, that I'm not my thoughts. And what happens, you realize, what happens is after a period of time, you realize if I'm not my thoughts, and who am I? What? Who am I? You know, I'm not the thoughts, I'm not the things I do, what am I? Who I am, and who I am is right here, right now, here, 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 yes. I get up in the morning. Excuse me. Let me take a hit here. I get up in the morning and if, besides coughing, the first thing I say is yes, yes, yes to the moment. Yes. Now, yes. Here, yeah. How are you right now, man? I mean, all there really is, you need to know this. I need to know this. All there really is right here, right now. This you get in meditation, the byproduct of it. Right here, right now. Here, 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 here. There's nowhere else. This is it. Anything outside of here is imagination. God created us good, never changed our mind. We're good now and we always will be and we always have been. We just have to have that realization. We're not We are not what we've done. We're not what we're going to do, or we're not what we're doing. Who we are and what we are is right here. And how are you right now? I'm okay. And how about another now? I'm right, I'm okay. And how about another now? I'm okay. We go through life being okay. But what we do is we imagine terrible things happening to us, imagining things that we don't want to have happen to us, and what we do is we scare ourselves with it. And that's why we go through life, and that's why I went through life being afraid, you know, with fearful, is because I imagine bad things happening to me. In other words, I thought scary thoughts. It's like I went to see the alien, and when that thing came out of the alien's chest, scared me bad. He followed me. And I told my buddy about it. He said, yeah, it's a spooky movie. And what I do, while we're all in the process of being okay right here, right now, all of us are okay right now, we run spooky movies and we scare ourselves. I want to thank you guys for asking me.